Hi, I'm Hillary Walsh, a serial entrepreneur, award-winning immigration lawyer, law professor, TEDx speaker, and raving Phoenix Suns fan. Over the past decade, I've helped thousands of immigrants live free in the United States. I'm talking work permits, social security numbers, green cards, their citizenship, VAWA, T visa, U visa, and lots of successful appeals. Here's the thing. Immigration law is super complicated and legal advice, well, it can be pretty expensive. So I created the Immigration Law Made Easy podcast to share my 10 plus years of experience with you for free. So if you're looking for tried and true, no BS, step-by-step strategies and tips on how to win your immigration case and live truly free in the United States, you're in the right place, my friend. Let's get started. I feel like I know you because I follow you on social media and I see all of your stuff every single day and you are at it, but it's a pleasure to have you on our podcast. You are Arizona State Senator. I know you were a journalist before.
Yeah.
And so that eases you into being public facing, but the amount of criticism that I imagine you get and the amount of discourse that you get is a whole other level because now you're telling the underdog story. You're not just telling the story that's going to be on the news tonight. You're telling a story that people don't even want to see on the news. And I imagine that attracts a lot of challenges. For me, I am in awe of you for that and I'm very appreciative of you for that. But how and why and all of those things?
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Hillary, for having me on. I'm really honored to be here. I was really looking forward to it. Yeah, there's so much to discuss, so it'll be a great conversation. But as you said, you know, I have most recently been under criticism over simply resharing information, publicly available information about where ICE is in our community. And Republicans are calling for me to be expelled from the legislature and even prosecuted by the Department of Justice. And it has been a whirlwind of a month since this story went viral from the far right troll account, Libs of TikTok. And I have received death threats. I have received threats to my personal safety and to the safety of my family. So it has been incredibly challenging and emotionally taxing, but I am determined to continue serving as a state senator for the people of Maryvale and Glendale. I was first elected to represent District 24 in 2022 in the House. I was born and raised here in Arizona, and I think so many people raised in Arizona, especially as brown kids, you know how hard it is to be raised in this state. I remember the terror of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. My parents are both educators, and the systemic underfunding of our public schools impacted our family and myself. And I grew up really wanting to fight back against injustice. I felt it was ingrained in me. And I actually went to ASU to become a journalist. And some of my first assignments, I was sent to the Capitol to report on what became, you know, very clear was horrible decisions by policymakers. So after being a reporter for a few years, I really continued to have that drive to do something more. And I decided to leave my news career about 1 year into Trump's first term to work at the ACLU of Arizona. I worked on criminal justice reform and immigration reform, and then eventually decided to run for the state legislature. And I'm honored to be in the Senate now.
Wow. Okay. So what birth order are you in your family?
So I'm one of six kids, a very big family, and I am the fifth. So I'm the youngest girl. And I think that's one of the reasons why I've never been afraid of a fight. I have four brothers and a sister with eldest daughter syndrome. And so definitely have
had to be scrappy.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to defend myself very often.
Okay. I mean, as you were describing, like all of the things you're going through right now, like I, as a business owner, have been sued. I have, as a business owner, had employees say negative things. As a business owner, have people say bad stuff about you online, and you can't really defend yourself because some of it is a one-way stream of information. That's about a business. That's a little bit about who I am as an attorney, but it's mostly about the business. And usually there's room for improvement within the business, let's be honest. But so much of what you're experiencing is so personal, and it's something that you fought so hard for. And like what you're describing, you're actually just reporting. You're just reporting all mm-hmm. over again. You're simply sharing information that's already public, and now it could be criminally prosecuted. So there's almost these like underlying themes of, I don't know what we would call it, but keeping the press, like there's almost a lack of freedom of the press when all you're doing is reporting. But anyway, as you were describing all that you're going through, and I can only imagine the stress that that puts on you in general, and then you're still so scrappy. I thought, I wonder where in her family birth order she is, because this is not something the grit you don't wake up with. It is something you've had instilled in you over the course of your lifetime.
Yeah, that explains it.
That may be. Do you know what your Enneagram is?
No.
No, I bet you're an 8. Like if you ever do the Enneagram, I think it's like the white girl Zodiac. I don't know. But
well, for the actual Zodiac, I'm an Aries. And Aries are also known to be very scrappy, very stubborn. So
okay, well, I love it. When you see what's going on right now and you see kind of some of the things that are happening, particularly for young people, people who are leaving high school and they're undocumented and they're entering the workforce, what are the thought processes that you have behind that as a politician, but also someone who's rooting for this demographic?
It's so infuriating to see how politicians have failed to bring forward a permanent pathway to citizenship, including the Democratic Party, right? I have always been so inspired by the dreamers I've met throughout my life who have shared their stories. When I was a reporter, I covered many stories of dreamers who were fighting for the right to be in the country where they grew up, the only country they've known in many cases. And there have been false promises again and again from politicians. And the fact that we have still not made progress and we are rapidly sliding backwards is terrifying. It's upsetting. And it makes me want to continue in this fight even more, because we know how valuable people who identify as dreamers are to our communities. They are friends, our family, our neighbors, our classmates, our coworkers. And the only reason why they have not been able to gain the same citizenship as anyone else is because of failures of politicians. And that is what I think many people in this discourse fail to understand.
It is, in my hot take, is kind of the modern day separate but equal. Because we've settled, I mean, in DACA, for so many young people who are like leaving high school right now, DACA is not even an option for them. Like they really are pushed out into just working under the table. They can go to college, good luck. But after you get done with college and after you've paid for this all out of pocket because you don't have access to FAFSA, you're going to be working under the table. But for people even who have DACA, like the select, you know, maybe 500,000 people in the United States who have this benefit, I don't know if we can call it that, but like have this protection, it really is a separate but equal. And it's almost like politicians have settled on this where people should be happy with what they've got. You should be happy with what you've got. And I think we have to just really push back on that and say that this is unacceptable, even from an economics perspective. Mm-hmm. When we look at what our kids who are graduating high school right now, our college students right now, anyone after 2016, when Trump was president the first time and said no more DACA, we haven't been able to get that engine restarted since then. And from an economics perspective, not allowing these young people who we've spent, I don't know, like maybe $500,000 on educating them through our education system, to not allow them to go work seems like the stupidest idea ever.
But yeah, absolutely. And it's completely contrary to what the United States likes to purport that we stand for. The hatred from the right that is fueling so much of this descent backwards is just atrocious, and it's red meat for the base. But you very often see similar themes to what immigrants from all countries have had to deal with since the founding of this country. We have so much work to do, and it should be a bipartisan effort to establish a permanent pathway. Yet you have Republicans who were willing to take a moderate stance just 5 years ago, or even back in 2022 when Arizona passed the in-state tuition for Dreamers. You see Republicans who stood for that who are now backtracking, all because they are afraid of Trump and the bigotry that he has allowed to run rampant. It's inexcusable.
I don't understand it. Sometimes, I don't know if you ever watched, my experience of politics is obviously just following you on social media and watching House of Cards. So I don't know if you watched House of Cards, but it has a lot of corruption within it in Washington, and everybody knows something dirty about everybody. That's the only answer that I can come to, is someone has something on all of these Republicans to where they will cow to whatever next, I don't even know if that's physically possible, but I just can't come up with any other logical explanation for why the backpedaling, why the lack of integrity, why it's not even flip-flopping. It is being cruel when you watch George W. Bush talk about how these are our neighbors, and he was speaking Spanish, and he was a Republican, and Reagan even, like, it doesn't make sense. None of it makes sense. So you have to kind of, I have to fabricate these like wild things to try to help my mind understand it. What do you do for fun in all of this, which is a very stressful time? What do you do for fun?
Yeah. Well, I love to hike and explore Arizona's beautiful landscapes. I play guitar. A lot of people don't know that.
I'm not very good,
but I do play guitar.
What kind of guitar?
Just acoustic.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And I really love to sing. I love music. I was a musical theater kid in high school.
Same. So yes. Really, yeah.
That's great. Yeah. So that's kind of how I de-stress, through music, through art, and through hiking.
How do you draw the boundary on focusing on everything you're fighting against, and then kind of saying, okay, I'm going to put down my weapons, my armor for the day, my shield and everything else, and now I'm just going to be? How do you do that in this season?
Yeah, it's challenging. There's no doubt about that. Before I ran for office, was a, you know, civil rights activist. I was a reporter, which did put me a little bit in the public eye. So I did have some of that experience of what it means to have to kind of separate yourself from the persona that's out there. I think one of the hardest things now, being even more in the public eye as a public official, is really understanding that everybody is going to have an opinion of me, and they are allowed to. I am someone who firmly believes that politicians should be held accountable for the decisions that they make. So when a constituent or a community member comes to me in good faith with something they want to talk about that they want me to do differently, I am always open to listen. With the social media comments, those very often are only to incite a reaction, to be personally insulting, or in the worst case, as I've had, to actually threaten me. So I do have to put a boundary there about how often I'm looking at the comments, how often I'm letting it really get to me, and understanding that I am in this role because the people of Maryvale and Glendale chose for me to represent them and to be their voice in the state Senate. That is my top duty. And that comes with sacrifices that I have chosen to make, which is to put myself out there publicly. But at the end of the day, the people who know me best, my family, my friends, that is what matters. No title can ever take away the people who love me and the people who are going to have my back no matter what. And that includes so many of my community members and my constituents as well, who have been so supportive throughout this entire process.
Yeah, you have a lot of fans.
So that is something I'm eternally grateful for, but definitely have to know when it's time to put the phone down, turn the phone off, and just be on a lease.
Yeah. Have you watched Ted Lasso yet?
No.
That's a good feel good if you want to unplug, and it has a lot of good leadership lessons in it.
Oh,
and,
great.
A broad use of the F word because it's set in England. And so their profanity is more socially acceptable on TV than in America. But anyway, when you think about planning, you have a set term and you have all these things that you want to do. How do you strategically get those things done when you have new stuff coming up every day from the administration?
Oh, it has been wild.
It seems like a planning nightmare.
Yes. My first 2 years in office in the state house, we still, you know, Biden was still president. We had a Democratic governor for the first time in a very long time. Republicans do control the House and Senate, so there was a divided government factor there. But we were able to get so much done. I was very proud to have played a key role in securing a historic investment for homelessness and affordable housing, and then also working to pass 2 affordable housing bills that were signed into law by Governor Hobbs. Now, this year, I come in my first year in the Senate, and everything has changed just because of the person in the White House and our Republican legislature that is so hell-bent on doing everything they can to get Trump's attention. And Turning Point USA, a radical, extreme right electoral group, they really run the state capitol under this current leadership. And it has been so challenging because we have to balance that political reality of, okay, I'm working on a bill. I want the Republican support because that's the only way it will get through the state Senate. And then on the other hand, having to put out fires with my constituency who are dealing with incredible crises facing their families, like a parent being deported, yeah, and the emergency situation that is for a family in crisis, or a constituent who called me because their boyfriend had been taken by ICE and they couldn't find him. These are the real realities that my constituents are facing. And in the minority party, where I can only get so much done on the policy side, I have to prioritize things.
Yeah.
Which means I have to drop everything on the policy side to make sure that that person can find their boyfriend who's been snatched up by the United States government and disappeared. That has taken a lot of my time and my assistant's time. I only have one assistant. She's amazing. And I do see that in this moment as my top priority. I'm also incredibly grateful to Congresswoman Yasemin Ansari and Senators Ruben Gallego and Mark Kelly, because on the federal level, they have a little bit more authority to be able to look into these cases where someone's family member has been taken by ICE or is being mistreated in a detention center. They have more authority to handle those types of inquiries. And I've been grateful because anytime I pick up the phone to let them know that a constituent needs help, they are there to do so.
His main assistant worked for John McCain. So mm-hmm. She really has been around for so long. So you're right. I remember when I very first started as an immigration lawyer here, when we got restationed here in Arizona, and I walked into, I don't even remember whose office it was at the time, but I walked in and they were able to help me. I kind of spilled my guts about, this is my client. This is what's going on. He's detained. He has DACA. Like, all of these really, really wrong things are happening. And this was during Trump 1.0. They are very helpful. They're also so flooded right now because everyone is needing so much help. I believe that you've been to the detention centers a few times, if I remember your social media correctly. Is that right?
I have not been to the detention centers. I've been to the courthouse.
Okay, got
it. Yes, where they were detaining people.
Yes.
And that was just horrible. We got calls from immigration attorneys who said, we'd never seen this tactic before. They were dismissing cases, and immediately after someone would walk out, ICE was there with masks, not identifying themselves, and detaining them. And that caused so much fear, because here you have folks that are trying to go through the process the way they're supposed to, they're following all of the rules, and then this is happening to them. And I've had people that are scared to go to their court date. They're scared to go to their regular check-ins with immigration. And so having to navigate all of that is just an impossible situation for people who again, only want to come here to do the right thing, to get a permanent pathway to citizenship and to be able to work and contribute.
For sure. And your area that you represent in Maryville, that's where my office is the largest, most concentrated demographic of Hispanics in all of the Phoenix metro area, definitely. Goodyear might have some. South Phoenix definitely has a very concentrated area, but that is your constituent base. And so it is such an interesting overlap for you being a state senator and having this federal issue just hammering and beating down on your constituency. It's really intense.
It is. It's horrible. People are living in fear. I had a constituent tell me that she is a United States citizen and she is so afraid that she's going to get pulled over and that they will not believe her when she tells them she's a citizen, that she's carrying her passport, not just her driver's license. And this is the reality that Latinos in Arizona, regardless of status, are dealing with right now. We've been here before under Arpaio and the unconstitutional policing that he was found guilty of in a court of law. We shouldn't have to be reliving this nightmare, and now on a national stage, but here we are.
Yeah, because so many people just moved to New Mexico, or they would move to a different state, left for California, and there is really nowhere to go because this is home, and this is targeting everyone. I mean, what are some happy stories, some success stories that you've had that you're like, I keep fighting because I know that we can help with this and I know we can help with that. And here are some of the results that I've been able to get.
I like this question because I feel as though it's something I do need to reflect on more. When it just comes to other issues, like housing, there have been some really great wins we've been able to get. I had one constituent who called because her mom had lived in an apartment complex for a very, very long time, and it had been bought out by new owners, and the owners were now going to raise the rent on these senior citizens who were on fixed incomes. And I worked to get the new property manager to pay for these residents' rehousing costs and some other benefits for them so that they would not have to carry this huge burden of being forced out of the place that they lived. So I was proud to have been able to negotiate that for that constituent, her mother, and her neighbors lived in that complex. I have constituents who wanted to build a casita in their backyard so that they could live rent-free, and the city banned it for a long time until we were able to pass a statewide bill legalizing backyard casitas. And one of my constituents just sent me a video of building his casita and kind of all the phases that it has gone through. And they just had a baby, so they're able to grow their family and all live, you know, on the same land. So that was a success story that I was really proud of. So there definitely are those little moments. It's tough because you want to do so much more. But I think that is really where I can have the most impact, is when I can pick up the phone and help direct a constituent to services that they might need. One of my constituents recently, her friend had become homeless, and she was telling me how she was hearing his story, and she thought to herself, I might just be one small person, but I know my state senator.
Amazing.
And when she said that, it just made my heart swell and just made me feel like I am here for a reason and I need to stay here. Because when people like Maria can pick up the phone and call me to get the help that she needed for her friend, that is really significant.
That is so touching.
And not every politician is going to be there to answer the phone.
Or care enough to.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm reflecting on the things that have been your wins, and they've been for individual people. They have not been for, I helped 10,000 people. Yes, I bet the casita option. I mean, that really aligns with even a Republican agenda where you should be able to do what you want to do with your property and your rights and all this other stuff, right? But that was for one person. And then, and even for your constituent, Maria, this was for one person. And so it is really beautiful to hear and to have a little bit of I guess, faith and humanity in the political system restored by hearing what you're talking about, because if you're doing it for one person at a time and you know that it has a greater impact, it is like the ripple effect. That is something that can keep all of us going, because when we feel overwhelmed by everything that we're doing, that's because our aperture is too broad. We really have to focus in on solving one problem in front of us so that we can help this one problem, and then the next problem or the next person to help will appear in due time. There's probably a line of them for you, and we go from there. But I think that is a really good way to beat overwhelm, is to think about one problem at a time. What do you want to be known for in your life?
I think one of the biggest things that I always pride myself on is never taking myself too seriously and bringing laughter and joy to people's lives. That's something that on those really hard days does give me hope and strength to keep going, is that I'm a very silly person for anyone who knows me. And I think
I would not know that about
that's
you.
That's an important thing to to have and to bring to the table, you know? And so those who know me best, including my campaign team and my constituents, some of my closest constituents, know that I'm a silly and fun person. And so when you ask that question, I'm like, yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things. I think the other thing would be just to, that even if I'm not successful, because one person can't change it all, so I'm not going to be the person that, you know, breaks down these deeply rooted systems and all of a sudden we have flowers and rainbows everywhere. But if I can pass on the vision of the world that I want to create and inspire other people to work towards that world, a world where all kids can go to school and get a good education, a world where no family has to live in fear of being separated, a world where everyone can have a safe place to lay their head at night. If I can inspire people to contribute to that world in whatever way that works for them, that will be enough.
When you think about young people today, how would you encourage them to consider carrying out your vision? Because we're grown-ass women at this point. We need, like, the next generation, we will hand the baton to them at some point when it's their time. And the young version of you that was 17, 18, 19, and then decided to go into college and then was a civil rights activist and journalist, what do you say to the young person today who doesn't really know where to go and feels a little hopeless?
So I'm an auntie to six kids, and I'm deeply motivated by making a better world for them. When I look at the state of the world right now, I can completely understand how young people might feel hopeless. I have had so many amazing young people work on my campaign who have given me so much hope, because they keep fighting in the face of challenges that I did not have to face at that age. I look at the way the world seems to be trying so hard to keep all of us isolated. I think I was just reading an article about how some high percentage of young people now actually talk to ChatGPT like it's a friend. And I think that isolation benefits the oppressor. And they have a vested interest in continuing to keep us isolated, so we aren't talking to one another, so we're not building power, so we aren't feeling alone. So one of the biggest ways we can resist is to break that by being in community with one another.
Yes.
So I often tell my nieces and my nephew, be nice to people, be kind to people, make a new friend, be a role model. They probably are like, oh, there's crazy auntie again texting us out of the blue to be a role model. But I think that is the advice that I give to them and that I would want to extend to other young people in the world, is that when your friends see you standing up in the face of injustice, when they see you putting yourself out there to join a new team or start a new hobby, then they're going to want to be inspired to do it too. And that community building is critical to changing the way things are right now.
Yeah, we were actually talking with the podcast, the folks who are making all of this happen. And they were talking about how Arizona is possibly the highest suicide. Phoenix is the highest suicide for young people.
Oh my gosh.
And it's heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking. And I remember being a teenager and life was hard and not really knowing what to do. And it's such a difficult time to go from you're a child to now you're starting to feel like an adult, but you don't have the responsibility and the autonomy of an adult. And that's a hard season. Mm-hmm. And then you're being influenced by so many people who you spend a lot of time with, and they're other young people, and they have different levels of autonomy that they are given by their parents, mm-hmm. or their caregiver, and what choices will they make. But I think that when we are in community, I think that's why I liked musical theater so much in high school. I really found just like you could be weird. You could not take yourself too seriously. And I don't know where, even as an adult, we get to do those types of things and be weird and not take ourselves too seriously on a normal basis. You have to go get drunk to do that as an adult. And I don't drink anymore. So it is one of those things where now I just do it. And I tell my kids, you have to learn not to get embarrassed because I'm going to be me. And I was letting this out, but it was in a different environment. But I think community really is, it is the key for so much of our unhappiness and a lot of our hopelessness. Because when we talk, even knowing you, air quotes, on social media, and then like being in a room with you, life is so different and the experience is so different. And so the more we're in community and actually in a room together anymore, I think that is so key to really finding hope when everything else looks hopeless. Because individually, we're great. It's the collective that becomes such a mess.
Right.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. I love to end with, what are you reading right now?
Oh, I'm reading such a good book called Plundered. It is about Black homeownership in Detroit. And the way that it's written is it starts with two families, one white family and one Black family, where the father, the grandfather of the family, gets a job at the Ford plant in Detroit at the height of car manufacturing, both UAW union workers, and then it follows the two family lines and what ended up happening to both of the families through a couple of generations when it comes to homeownership. And it analyzes the stark differences for Black Americans and white Americans in this journey of homeownership. And it specifically talks about the policies in Detroit that contributed to severe racist outcomes and inequities. It is so good. And I feel like as a policymaker, we so often think that bills look really good on paper, but then the way they actually play out when implemented can often cause more harm than good. So it's given me so much to think about as a policymaker, and it's a page turner. It's nonfiction, but these characters are just, you know, people that you instantly feel connected to. Strongly recommend it.
I love it. Thank you so much for that. I have a follow-up question. With when you're making law and you're writing policy and you're trying to get things passed, is there like a section within our lawmaking system that reviews it and anticipates what the second and third and fourth order effects are going to be?
Not at all. And I think this is one of the things that motivated me to run for office, was that I would go to these committee hearings and I would see the way that lawmakers so flippantly made decisions, often just based off emotion and how they happened to be feeling that day. It's just legislating off vibes. And there were experts who would show up to testify, whether it was a healthcare bill and there were doctors, or it was a bill impacting our criminal justice system and you had experts in substance abuse treatment who were coming to say, this bill will have a horrible impact. We have data, we have evidence that it's not going to work the way you are saying it will. And yet they pass the bills anyway. And this is a huge problem, both on the state level and on the federal level. So we need to change so much about our system. But one of the things is that we need to elect people who actually give a damn about facts and evidence and data.
And second and third order effects, because even the, and I know it's not an Arizona statute, but the Lake and Riley bill that was passed.
Exactly.
If you are arrested for shoplifting, you're subject to mandatory detention. All you have to do is that doesn't mean you're convicted. That could just be a wrongful identification and you get arrested. It could have been your brother, or it could have been absolutely not you and someone's just doing it to be a jerk, and yet you're subject to mandatory detention. This is the crazy effects when we have such, I mean, it seems well-meaning. Like, if you're shoplifting, this can be a problem. Okay, I understand where the idea is coming from. But when it's just an arrest, it's not actually a conviction. We really have a problem because we're shortcutting our criminal justice system and then punishing someone who was presumed innocent, even if arrested. And we shortcut things in that way.
Right. And as we do that, we are just slowly chipping away at constitutional freedoms for everyone.
Everyone.
And it might look like a good splashy headline, or something that a Democrat could put on their, you know, mail piece to say they worked across the aisle. But at what cost? That's what we have to be asking ourselves.
Yeah. Well, I am a fan. I am appreciative. And you have so many people who are rooting for you. So thank you for helping one person at a time. It really, really matters. And keep going. Like, to the extent that you feel tired, I hope that you know you have lots of people behind you encouraging you.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you for the work you do. It is so important. You are doing the frontline work of protecting people in the courts. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
My friend, I'm so glad you joined me today. If you have a friend or family member who may need some immigration law guidance or even just day-to-day encouragement, please send them a text or email or a DM on social media and say, hey, I think this podcast is going to help you. I sure wish someone had given me the tips I'm sharing here years and years ago when I was starting out as an immigration lawyer. Thank you so much for being here. I'll see you next week, same time, same place. Adios.